Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
From the New Books Network, this is New Books in Geography. I'm your host, Dino Kadic. If you've ever crossed a border, you've probably thought about the boundaries of the law. When I lived in Arizona, I passed this pair of motorcycle police hunting for speeding tickets every day. I always thought it was so funny how they parked right next to the sign that said, "Welcome to Oro Valley," the town that they worked for. It was like they were their suburb's border police. By the time I got to my father's house, I had already crossed in and out one more time. Messy, messy maps. But, as it turns out, territory isn't the law's only edge. Enter Alex Jeffrey's new book, The Edge of Law, Legal Geographies of a War Crimes Court, which uses the case of the Court of Bosnia and Herzegovina to show how the law and legal processes are socialized. Running his way through court spaces, civil society activism, and international cooperation, Alex shows how the production of legal space and its boundaries serves to make claims to some responsibilities and not others, at the same time obscuring the law's relationship with other spaces and times. It's an excellent book, and I really enjoyed talking to Alex in his office at Emmanuel College, University of Cambridge, earlier this year. In the interest of full disclosure, I should also let you know that he's my PhD supervisor. Here's our conversation. Alex, welcome to New Books in Geography, and congratulations on the publication of your second book.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start off by hearing a little bit about your background. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Right, well, I studied geography. I've always been a geographer. I studied geography as an undergraduate at Edinburgh University. While I was there, I was lucky enough to meet Ellie Maxwell, a fellow student who was interested in and running a reconciliation charity, children's charity, in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And if it's okay with you, I'll just refer to Bosnia and Herzegovina as Bosnia for the remainder of this interview. So Ellie was running Firefly Youth Project in the northern Bosnian town of Brčko. And after my studies, I was lucky enough to spend a year volunteering and working with Firefly, splitting my time between Edinburgh and Brčko. And it was a really an incredible experience in terms of both kind of giving me a sense of the nature of post-conflict Bosnia and meeting incredible people in Brčko and beyond, who were working in this in the field of reconciliation with young people, but also perhaps more profoundly, generating a real interest in the institutional architecture of post-conflict Bosnia. This was in 1999. It was only 4 years since the signing of the Dayton Peace Accords, so things in Bosnia were still quite precarious, particularly in Brčko, which had been left out of the original peace accords, had been established in 1999 as a special district, was a real site of experimentation. So that's what I then wrote my PhD was about, this process of reconstructing Brčko district, how forms of power sharing between different groups in Bosnia had functioned in Brčko, and really the kind of politics of international intervention in Bosnia as a whole. That kind of interest culminated in the writing of my first book, The Improvised State, with the Royal Geographical Society book series. And in that book, I was exploring the kind of competing ideas of the state in Bosnia, and how different actors were attempting to try and garner respect and trying to present their activities as state-like, using the work of Pierre Bourdieu and his conceptual vocabulary of different species of capital as a way of trying to talk through these competing practices of the state. And it, you know, over the years became clear, and in particularly over the last decade or so, that a particularly significant aspect of state building was the aspect of law and the attempt to use law as a political tool, a political technology perhaps, through which particular ideas of the state may be conveyed. Now, for me, a specific case in the use of law was the foundation of the court of Bosnia and Herzegovina in Sarajevo around 2005, and in particular the court's responsibility for war crimes trials and the shifting responsibility from the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague to the court in Sarajevo, and how this new responsibility for war crimes trials was being portrayed as part of this state-building effort. And so suddenly we have this really interesting confluence between law and politics and the desire for a legal institution to perform a political function. So this is what is explored in this second book, The Edge of Law. I'm interested in the ways in which the court has, or the kind of interesting ways in which the court has played a political function in contemporary Bosnia.
Great, thanks. So I want to delve into the book, but first, just for listeners who aren't as familiar with the context, could you talk a little bit about transitional justice in Bosnia and state building and how those two things came to intersect?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and quite potentially lengthy story that I'll try and abridge. The interesting part of the kind of transitional justice story in Bosnia comes because it in many ways has been a kind of laboratory of techniques of transitional justice. So this phrase transitional justice refers to attempts to provide redress, generally understood as legal redress, although, you know, there's an issue that clearly what's understood as justice or redress for the past extends beyond legal functions, but generally understood to be redress for crimes committed under a previous political regime, often centering on crimes committed during conflict. And so we've seen very significant attempts in the 20th century to establish systems of transitional justice. A case that's often identified is that of the Nuremberg trials after World War II as being a very prominent example of an attempt to try and provide legal redress for the crimes of the Nazi regime by trying a select number of individuals for specific crimes committed during the Second World War. In the case of Bosnia, in 1993, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia was established by the United Nations Security Council. Now, the interesting thing about the ICTY's establishment is it was created while the conflict was still ongoing. So this wasn't so much a post-conflict legal instrument. This was an institution created while the violence in Bosnia and Herzegovina was still ongoing. So it was created in 1993, a full 2 years before the conflict ended. Its central tribunal was in The Hague. And its function was really to focus on the key significant military and political leaders that were seen as being responsible for the violence enacted during the fragmentation of Yugoslavia. So beyond just the borders of Bosnia, but in terms of the kind of wider process of violent disintegration of the Yugoslavian state between 1992 and 1999. So the ICTY's role then was quite a narrow role because, of course, the extent of culpability moved beyond simply those military and political leaders. So the ICTY ended up, over the course of its lifespan, trying 161 individuals for crimes committed during the fragmentation of Yugoslavia. So it's quite a narrow field. The desire to complete the mandate for the ICTY, but also to shift the responsibility for war crimes trials onto the successor states within Yugoslavia, meant that over the course of the early 2000s, attempts were being made to try and establish a clear completion timeline for the ICTY to wind down its activities, in the end to shift its activities to what's termed the residual mechanism, which now since 2017 the ICTY has ceased to function as a legal tribunal and has now shifted any remaining cases or appeals to the residual mechanism, but to shift responsibility instead to the court in Sarajevo. In order to do that, a quick kind of legal background, in order to do that, the international community had to establish a new criminal code in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the 2003 criminal code, which superseded the 1976 Yugoslav criminal code. Now, that seems like a very dry legal technicality, but actually it was a particular legal innovation which allowed the transfer of cases and the investigation of war crimes cases in Bosnia. So that permitted the establishment of the court in Sarajevo, then in 2005, and that's when the legal the system of cases and investigations and transfer of trials could take place.
Great. Yeah. So I think that brings us to the building itself, which is a really important site in this book. So where was this court built, and why did that matter?
Well, it's a really kind of, you're right, it's a really interesting part. And I think I've been inspired in my work on the work on legal architecture by people like Linda Malkahi, who's really convincingly for me argued that the material spaces of law aren't just neutral backdrops against which the legal process unfolds, but they're actively enrolled in the production of legal meaning. And so, you know, in Linda's work, she explores that through the history of court buildings within the United Kingdom and explores the ways in which particular articulations of space reflect particular social understandings of law and then go on to then intervene in those understandings. They are themselves productive of understandings of law and the legitimacy of particular legal processes. So in the case of the court in Bosnia, it's located in a former army barracks about 5 kilometres outside the centre of Sarajevo, in what I initially felt was a quite kind of unassuming spot, quite kind of a functional decision to locate the court somewhere that could be securitized. It's well defended by a perimeter fence. it's outside of the center of the city, which may serve some security imperative. But when I talk to members of the court's public information and outreach service, they said that the building had been chosen because by the time they were establishing the court in 2005, all the good buildings in the center of Sarajevo had been taken by other institutions. So there wasn't the kind of capacity for a kind of symbolic structure that could convey this new legal institution and its preeminence within the Bosnian state. But actually, when we start to employ that kind of that history, that genealogy of this building, something else is revealed, because the building was, as I said, a former army barracks. During the Yugoslav period, it was named Viktor Bubanja Barracks after the partisan hero in World War II, Viktor Bubanja. And over the course of the conflict in the 1990s, so in 1992, the barracks was renamed Ramiz Selcin after a fighter for the Bosnian government army who had died defending Sarajevo during early in the siege. So in some ways we see in that moment a desire to use the naming of this military site to embed a particular geopolitical regime, to kind of supersede the Yugoslav past, to impose a claim from the Bosnian government's present. And so this use of naming, but the story is kind of slightly more complex, because after the conflict, the barracks it was used as a prison facility during the conflict itself, and then after the conflict it lay derelict before it was taken up in the early 2000s to be used as a court. Court building or set of court buildings. But the story becomes more complex, because in 2010 and 2011, three individuals were indicted for crimes committed at the war, at the military barracks, while they were being used as a prison complex during the 1990s conflict. So we have this very kind of complex situation whereby individuals are being indicted and serve trial for crimes committed within the very building where their court cases are taking place. And so it's a very kind of complex symbolic geography here, where this was drawn upon by opponents of the court as being a signal of the lack of neutrality in this site. And I think there's a lot we could say about the problematic idea of any space or place being actually neutral, but certainly it was drawn upon as being a site where the crimes have been committed against Serb prisoners of war. This is what the indictments were for. They were used by the Bosnian government army and were seen as being a site of crimes against Serb prisoners of war. It was picked up by civil society groups, so Serb camp detainee associations marched on the court building, wanted a plaque placed on the court building to specify the crimes. It has to be said that the crimes that those civil society groups and other political commentators referred to were of a magnitude much greater than that contained within the indictments and in the subsequent trial hearings. But we've got to be clear here. This is a symbolic geography that had carried particular power. So one of the first people to be transferred from The Hague to Sarajevo was Radovan Stanković. And Radovan Stanković was tried and found guilty for mass rape in the eastern Bosnian town of Foča. And he used in his ICTY hearings for the transfer from The Hague to Sarajevo, he used this past to say that look, there's still the blood of Serb inmates on the walls of the former Viktor Bubanja barracks. How can this be a place where he, as a Serb, can hear have a fair hearing? So it shows the kind of powerful symbolic geography that was carried through this site location. And I think there's a really interesting for me geographical point here, and that is that often this imagination of the creation of a new institution presents the process of construction, of building selection, of the establishment of a particular bureaucratic instruments as one of novelty, of almost the kind of a clean break, a clean line, a clean birth of a new institution, unbridled by the associations of the past. And I think the story of Viktor Bubanja barracks, the Rami Selcin barracks, and then into being the court in Bosnia and Herzegovina points to the fantasy that this imagination of the emergence of the new as being something that is a clean break from the past, and instead points to the ways in which these processes are always embedded in the kind of actual existing material legacies of events of the past. And I think one of the kind of problematics has been the absence of maybe a kind of formal response to this site location and a formal acknowledgement of the implications of this choice of site, and instead it's circulated within these quite informal channels and has permitted this imagination of some form of bias to be propagated by particularly by opponents to the legal process. I'm also really reminded, and I've been very much influenced by the work of Carol Clarkson and her brilliant book, Drawing the Line, which is a book about the aesthetics of transitional justice. And she particularly focuses on the case of judicial processes following the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa. And one of the things I find most kind of interesting in her work is to point to the kind of aesthetics of these processes, that they are not without kind of aesthetic practice, and that then leads to new forms of interpretation. I mean, she looks at the kind of aesthetics of the construction of the court in Hillbrow in Johannesburg as a moment that imposed and established a new legal regime and used that aesthetics as a deliberate mechanism to break from the apartheid past. Now, I think what's happened in the case of Sarajevo and the court is almost an inadvertent aesthetics. This hasn't been choreographed. In some senses, in thinking back to my previous book, it's kind of been improvised. You know, there's been a set of symbolic reference points that are produced through its connection to past events. And those symbolic reference points have certain capital that people can use to challenge the authority and legitimacy of the court.
Thank you. Yeah, I really got the sense that many people working around the court felt that their kind of new prerogative, new attempts were being disrupted by old issues. And I think what you really show is that there is no new or old. It's all there. It's all embedded. So I think that brings me to all of these different people working around the court, different victims' rights groups, different people whose mission was explicitly to kind of bolster the legitimacy of the court. So could you talk about how NGOs became part of this process and what role that they had?
Of course, yeah. And so this was really the center of the research project on the establishment of the court, was to explore the ways in which its work, the trial processes, were communicated to the wider Bosnian public, the ways in which the establishment of the court required forms of communication and collaboration with wider civil society groups. So the interesting thing about the establishment of the court in Sarajevo was that from the very outset, it had a public outreach strategy, which was a kind of innovation. This is not something that the ICTY actually engaged with for the first 6 years of its existence. From 1993 to 1999, it had no public outreach strategy. And so this was seen broadly as an error, because it made the work of the court more difficult. And I could explain in some detail why, you know, the outreach strategy is important. But this was corrected in the case of the court in Sarajevo, which had an outreach strategy from the very outset. And this outreach strategy was structured around the establishment of a court support network. So this was a network of non-governmental organisations that would work with the court to communicate the court's activities, to try and facilitate victims to come forward with new reports of crimes committed during the conflict, and to assist with the process of gathering testimony on which court cases could be founded. So the court support network involved NGOs distributed across the territory of Bosnia, so in both the Republika Srpska, the Serb-orientated part of Bosnia, and within the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, so in parts that align themselves with Croat interests and with Bosniak or Bosnian Muslim interests. And so the kind of wide diversity of civil society groups. And there was funding initially for a short period that these NGOs would communicate formally with the court. They would have a phone line with the court that they could find out information rapidly about what was taking place. They would also, you know, help to facilitate the court by involving public visits or student visits to the court itself, to sit in the public gallery. And so they would be kind of conduits of information. I think the plan as well was very much that this would be a network. So the court support network was going to actually kind of correspond with one another and communicate with each other. So connections could be forged across the territory of Bosnia. Clearly, you know, aspects of the establishment of legal process in Bosnia have been very much established within the different entities, the Federation or the Republika Srpska. And so this was an attempt to try and reach across different parts of Bosnian territory to communicate the activities of the court. I would say, just as a kind of initial point, the interesting thing here is an acknowledgement that the legitimacy granted to a new legal institution isn't understood to be naturally emergent through the establishment of the building or the enactment of trials. The foregrounding of public outreach and the creation of the court support network does reflect a kind of fundamental acknowledgement that this is a process of communication, that in the end, this requires the kind of consent of the Bosnian public in order for this, for the legal processes to work. And I think that is a as I said, a radical shift. It's a radical shift in the sense that it sees this transitional justice process not just in procedural terms, i.e. the enactment of legal cases, but in quite substantive terms, that actually it requires a substantive and wider public acceptance that this is a just and legitimate legal institution in order for it to successfully function. And so the research that we conducted was very much, as you say, focused on the voices of these civil society groups, which were quite diverse. They were kind of victims' rights associations. They were affiliates of international civil society groups. They were women's associations. They were a kind of wide variety of different groups. And they themselves put us in touch with a broader network of NGOs and social movements which were involved in this area. So we ended up with this kind of rich picture of the ways in which the court's activities had been received and then reworked by those that were seen as their primary audience. So I've been very much influenced here by the work of people like Wendy Lamborn and Bryony Jones, people who have worked on transitional justice in very different settings, but have also looked at this question of public outreach and the ways in which public outreach itself produces a kind of set of political responses to the activities of the court.
And that's really interesting because these are really adverse conditions for the kind of trust, for the kind of belief in institutions that this kind of institution requires. So how do you see that that feeling of trust or distrust play out in the context of Bosnia?
I think it's a really, really apt question. And I think this process of trust and the very fragile nature of trust in these forms of institution is a crucial backdrop to the book as a whole. But particularly when thinking about the workings of civil society groups. So, I mean, my headline point would be that trust in many of the interactions that we had in the process of researching this area, many of the interactions centered on a lack of trust and a distrust in the ability of the legal process to really deliver the kind of transitional justice that individuals and groups were seeking. Now, there's two reasons for that. One procedural and one substantive. The procedural one was that many of the individuals that were involved in this research had felt let down by the processes, the legal process of transitional justice as enacted through the ICTY or enacted through the Court of Bosnia, because the trials had reached a conclusion and had not established the outcome that they were seeking. That there is a great tension in work on transitional justice generally, in the problem that sentences do not deliver the kind of punitive outcome that many of the individuals within the victims' associations, victims' witnesses who have come forward would expect, that sentences are seen as unduly lenient. That and there's an affiliated issue here. That is that there is a problem about using a retributive process, so a trials process seen as trying to deliver retribution to an individual or group for crimes committed in the past. So this retributive focus of both the ICTY and the court in Bosnia has allowed individuals to be sentenced for their crimes. But of course, what it does not do is establish a public truth. Because even if a sentence has been passed and someone has been found guilty, if they do not themselves acknowledge that these crimes took place, if they continue to profess their innocence, then the historical record is still conflicted. And many of the participants in the research would talk about the fact that they, the guilty party would end up serving a short prison sentence, sometimes a short prison sentence not served within Bosnia, but served in a third-party state, and that would be seen as a kind of privileged outcome. They may well then claim asylum in that third-party state. So there was an argument that this was this didn't assist in building kind of trust in the legal process, and that really kind of follows on to the second point about the kind of focus on law. Was that of course for many of the individuals participating, the outcome that was desired was not so much the retribution, but also the issue of the missing human remains, so people wanting to find the missing remains of their loved ones, maybe for compensation as well, for their loss. So a kind of wider halo of issues that weren't covered by the legal process that were seen as fundamental to trying to build trust in the transitional justice process. So I think you know, I don't want to in any way, and I don't think in the book, undermine the significance of the establishment of the court as being a really fundamental step in creating a judicial backdrop and a sense of ending impunity and fostering a sense of culpability of particular individuals. But I think this took place within a context of kind of grave distrust of certain international institutions, and also a sense of the incompleteness of the process, that simply a retributive process was always going to be in some senses incomplete.
So I really want to kind of continue on that point and start to think about the legal commons and that those pressures and demands put on the concept of justice. But before we do that, one more thing about these kinds of NGO constellations. It really seemed to me that there was also a normative component, a state-building component to this civil society part, which is that not only does civil society kind of put pressures, demands, help to make the court, but also that the process of doing that actually does something itself. It creates a new kind of citizenship in Bosnia. So can you talk about how civil society and the court was pictured as a space of citizenship and how that actually panned out?
Absolutely. And again, it is a part of the book that it's a central part of the book is to focus on this, the kind of political subjectivities, the kind of how individuals who participating within the court support network and other affiliated organizations was much about kind of generating a sense of, citizenship, in terms of participation in the state and the ways in which this was about kind of thickening a geography of the state through these attempts to communicate activities of the court. One of the distinctions I make in the book is between the invited kind of judicial process, kind of invited spaces whereby the court process, legal process unfolds. So obviously, the invited process being the court trial processes, entering the court building, the kinds of workshops and seminars that were an aspect of communicating the activities of the court. So I take these kind of invited spaces and kind of compare them or set them against the invented spaces of justice, the invented spaces of law that we see that work through civil society. So for these, I look at the really kind of fleeting sites and practices whereby civil society actors would be working with members of society to attempt to try and communicate the work of the court, or to enroll that individual in a particular activity of the court. So an example would be a group we're talking to in Mostar that talked through the challenge of approaching someone who could give testimony in the court, and that this individual had been approached by the ICTY, who'd sought to simply issue a subpoena and demand that this person gives testimony. And this was seen as very unsuccessful because the person found that quite disorientating, but did not appreciate that kind of sort of formal, quite aggressive approach by the ICTY. And they were comparing that with the approach they had, which was to sit with this person, for a number of days while they did their agricultural labor, drinking raki with this person, plum brandy, and kind of gaining a rapport with this individual to talk through what the judicial process would involve, what the court trial process would involve, why giving testimony was significant, not in terms of a kind of individualized benefit, but the more collective benefit to some sense of a future Bosnian state and the idea of ending impunity. And so, you know, I see that as a kind of invented space of justice, a kind of invented space whereby forms of interaction that are both bodily, but they're kind of involved in kind of forms of materiality, they're very much situated in certain places and settings. They are fundamental to the operation, actually, of the court. And so the argument isn't that to identify that there are invited and there are invented spaces of justice in contemporary Bosnia, because that much is quite straightforward, but to explore the way that they're entangled. You know, the ways in which actually these invited processes, the legal cases, requires these invented sites. And so in some senses, we do see, coming back to your question, we do see the court support network and the kind of enrollment of civil society as being part of a kind of citizenship building program in Bosnia to communicate certain ideas of the Bosnian state as a unified and multi-ethnic whole. And so in that sense, we could see it as part and parcel of the long process since 1995 of trying to communicate and unify a sense of the Bosnian state through international instruments, and thereby through kind of permitted forms and privileged forms of civil society that fit that normative framework. But it is not just that, because by undertaking this work and interviewing over a number of years, civil society groups that are participating in this work, they are knowing actors that use these frameworks to promote and pursue particular ideas of solidarity, particular ideas of political subjectivity that extend beyond, I think, these, you know, the often quite dry or quite hollowed out ideas of citizenship connected to this utopian multi-ethnic state, and instead focus on, I suppose, what we'd see as the kind of acts of citizenship, the kind of more everyday, mundane practices through which forms of solidarity are built and lived.
Great. Yeah, I think that really kind of gets us into thinking about what's so interesting and productive about your research. So on the one hand, sort of more conventional views of the law see it, it's very kind of territorial in terms of jurisdiction. And right, we talked about this idea of neutrality, but even kind of more critical views of the law historically have undertaken almost the same kinds of flattening that this conventional view takes. And I think your idea of the legal commons and the edge of the law really using kind of a geographical perspective really get at the ways that law is uneven and moving and a tool, but also a space of possibility. So I guess that's a very, very broad, but can you talk a bit about the legal commons and about the edge of law and how they kind of help us better understand this specific context, this like conflict, post-conflict, contradictory legal sphere, but also our understanding of the law more broadly?
Absolutely. The book is entitled The Edge of Law. Because I was interested in the ways in which law has been productive of space in Bosnia, and so this started out, I think, in my mind as the ways in which law was being used in this very kind of territorial sense. And so I started out by thinking, well, the obvious edge of law is that of jurisdiction, so the kind of territorial extent of legal sovereignty over a particular space. And so that space being the territory of the Bosnian state. But very quickly, when we think about the kind of edge of law, we start to think of the really plural and multi-scalar ways in which law is being productive of space. And so we've already talked about the kind of architectural points and the kind of materiality of the built environment. But of course, and the book goes into this in a little bit of detail, but a lot more could be said about the kind of edge of law being the edge of the body and the ways in which the human body becomes enrolled both in life and in death, actually, as a form of evidence, but that the body becomes enrolled as a subject within law, as a subject of, that gives testimony, as a subject in the site of punishment, and as a site of evidence. And so it becomes a lot more kind of fragmented, this question of the edge of law. But I think what it does do is focus our attention on this space-making qualities and the place-making qualities of legal process, of a legal process. So that was the kind of reasoning behind that. I think also the reasoning was that much work within critical legal studies has focused on the ways in which law presents itself as being separate from wider society. Now, that makes complete sense in a way that law and the legal process, such as trials, requires particular forms of expertise. And so we think about the ways in which legal expertise is detached from many of the wider social processes and forces and agendas, and is instead a form of kind of cold rationality that through which legal deliberation can take place. I'm always reminded of, when I teach on this the issue of the image of justice that you see on court buildings, and certainly in England, on sort of 18th and 19th century court buildings, of justice being a female figure who is blindfolded, an imagination of justice being blind. It is a cold evaluation of the facts themselves and blind to wider social forces. So, of course, what's taken place then has been one of attempting to segregate legal processes from wider social forces. Now, that idea of legal closure, of separation, of what the brilliant legal geographer Nick Blomley would see as a form of bracketing, of kind of bracketing off certain forms of deliberation from wider society, that's been critiqued quite widely by scholars across a range of disciplines of the social sciences. And so I wanted to kind of give a particular kind of legal geography take to these processes of critique by exploring this production of the edge of law, not as something rigid and fixed, but something that is always being transgressed. It's perhaps a fantasy, a desire to think of law having edges, but actually in practice they are constantly being dissolved and transgressed and reworked. But the edge itself remains quite a kind of powerful political instrument. So that's explored in different ways by thinking about legal expertise, by thinking about the separation in the urban landscape, but also thinking about the ways in which, you know, in practice through tools that we've discussed today at some length, but, you know, things like the court support network, that edge is always being kind of transgressed and unsettled. This point about the legal commons, I mean, I think what it comes back to, actually, and I didn't mention this when we talked about the origins of this work. I mean, I started on this project as well in really quite a hopeful mindset. You know, it started out as a hopeful piece of work, because I was, having studied the intervention in Bosnia and thinking about the establishment of the Bosnian state, what was relatively dispiriting. Many of the initiatives that have been attempted have not functioned in the ways that they were intended. They've had a whole series of unintended consequences that have led to new forms of discriminatory politics, new forms of fragmentation, new forms of marginalization. So actually I started this whole project in quite a kind of hopeful mindset that what we were seeing in Bosnia was a reflection of this the legal commons that's emerging around human rights law, emerging around international attempts to institutionalize transitional justice through permanent mechanisms such as the International Criminal Court. And unquestionably, this has been an important factor in this process. I think that what we see is in two ways. One, simply the moral legitimacy to undertake trials for crimes in the past sets out a clear agenda that is one of ending impunity and one of, you know, that there are certain crimes that are of such magnitude they require forms of legal redress regardless of the change in political circumstances. But also I think what we see is that the desire for Bosnia or attempts to have been made for Bosnia to conform to broader human rights law. And this is part of the book, towards the end of the book, where I start to think about the competing kind of international agendas we see coexisting in Bosnia, particularly where the European Court of Human Rights has passed judgments that have challenged the outcome of trials at the court in Sarajevo. For example, war crimes trials that have been challenged. But I see that as a not necessarily wholly in negative terms, but rather the desire for the Bosnian state to be beholden to international legal norms, to enforce those norms in ways that have not taken place in some of the most high-profile cases, for example, the Sjedić and Finci case, where, of course, the Bosnian constitution was taken to the European Court of Human Rights and found to be in contravention of the European Convention on Human Rights. And it's been a decade of non-implementation of that ruling. So I think that for me, the legal commons is a powerful imaginative realm that is having some institutional kind of manifestations, but certainly for those working in civil society and working for some of the most prominent actors, this was a powerful set of resources that not only had legal outcomes, but motivated them to continue to work towards trying to end impunity and seek for forms of redress for crimes of the past.
So I think this is a great segue into the last empirical chapter, which is called Entrance Strategies. And it was one I really enjoyed. So it wasn't just that these kind of geopolitical questions in the court were questions of Bosniaks, Serbs, and Croats, but there were also other geopolitical forces at work. We've talked a little bit kind of abstractly about internationals and the international community, but can you tell us a little bit about what an entrance strategy is?
Of course, yeah. No, it's I'm glad you enjoyed the chapter. I enjoyed writing it an awful lot, actually, because it's a chapter I wrote last. And it's a chapter that, you know, the title suggests, Entrance Strategies. It's writing against the imagination of the exit strategy, which has been so dominant in kind of geopolitical narratives over the last 20 years, where interventions by powerful international actors, such as the United States, have been structured around the idea of exit, that an intervention can be made within a sovereign state, maybe a military intervention such as we saw in Iraq, and then thereby it's working towards an exit strategy, the handing over of sovereignty to domestic political institutions and the exit of international actors. And so this chapter is troubling that temporal imaginary and saying instead what we see in Bosnia are certainly transformations in the ways in which international actors are participating in the governance of the Bosnian state. But this does not neatly align with withdrawal of those actors. And so the idea of entrance strategies is to explore the mechanisms through, and clearly in line with the interests of the book, the legal mechanisms through which international agendas and international institutions continue to pursue particular strategies. And so in the case of that chapter, we look at a number of different actually legal cases, but particularly focusing on the ways in which the US government has sought to assist in transformations in Bosnian citizenship law over the last 20 years. And so the ways in which Bosnia has gone through a change in its citizenship law, which suspended and then withdrew the citizenship of a large number of individuals who had fought for the Bosnian government army, often with ties to Islamic states, and have sought to stay and become resident and were granted citizenship in Bosnia. But in line with this new citizenship law, were seen as a threat to the Bosnian state due to their connections with Islamist ideology. And so the chapter traces the really quite mundane ways in which the US government has sought to support the withdrawal of citizenship of these individuals, thereby seeking to kind of influence the very makeup of the Bosnian state, though clearly in a way that is covert and hidden, so it's kind of after exit, but is a form of entrance. It's a mechanism that allows the continued agenda of an external actor to be pursued through the Bosnian state. I think it also, you know, for me, I suppose I wanted to end on a kind of geopolitical note, really, to talk about the kind of continuities of particular geopolitical agendas within the Bosnian state and the ways in which Bosnia continues to perform a really important kind of role and function and symbolism within these kind of wider geopolitical dramas. And I think that this process of entrance and the ways in which, you know, the US government has, by buying photocopiers and night vision goggles, sought to continue to pursue a particular geopolitical agenda, is evidence of these forms of entrance.
Thank you. So we have to start to wrap up, but before we do, I want to talk about something that you said in the conclusion, which really struck me. So what you said was that sort of talking about the embodied nature of law, it's not just nuance, it's not just kind of scholars adding their own twist, but actually that embodied nature explains why legal processes face these challenges and roadblocks. And I think to that I would add kind of like the political economy of it, the fact that so many people are leaving the country, right? Like, all of these things have a role in the making of whatever justice is in Bosnia. But I wanted to ask, kind of, given these embodied limitations, what possibilities for justice do you think remain in Bosnia?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And in a legal system that is facing thousands of war crimes cases still under investigation, some with named perpetrators, some without, this can seem like a kind of impossible conundrum, you know, an impossible conundrum due to the sheer magnitude of the legal challenge. But I don't think it is impossible. And the reason I don't think it's impossible is because actually having undertaken this research and obviously having worked in and being engaged in the kind of politics of Bosnia for the last 20 years, there are glimpses and there are really hopeful processes still taking place. I think for me, the very kind of banal starting point would be that it is very important that these legal processes at the court continue, however imperfect and however open to political challenge. They do form a normative framework whereby the trials for crimes of the past are recognised. However, I believe that the one major innovation that's been missing in Bosnia is some form of truth and reconciliation commission or process that can adequately attend to the broader social dissatisfaction with the pace and scale of legal redress and legal processes. So there is a requirement, however late and however seemingly imperfect, to establish some form of truth-telling commission that can act to consolidate and bring people together as a site through which the events of the past, and let's be honest, the events of the present, are adequately acknowledged and reflected upon. The challenge is huge, and I'm not going to sit here, like some kind of utopian bystander saying, why aren't those things taking place? It's quite clear why those things aren't taking place, and it's the political landscape and economic landscape of Bosnia and Herzegovina is entirely set against precisely that kind of open-endedness. So it's happening elsewhere. It's happening amongst young people who are coming together and thinking about alternative ways of understanding the state. It's happening in civil society groups that are communicating and thinking about and talking about the past, present and future in ways that are conducive to life, conducive to people living and being together. And so I want to remain hopeful, even in the face of clearly a set of outcomes that have been less than perfect, and in a political landscape that is not kind of showing the kinds of transformations and consolidations I think that many would have imagined in the 1990s, would have imagined that this sort of thing would have, that kind of Richard Holbrooke, the chief negotiator of Dayton, seeing Dayton as a temporary measure, this imagination that the passage of time was somehow going to lead to the consolidation of the state. That's a kind of infantilizing and problematic image, and it's completely untrue too. So what's actually, what we actually see clearly are the continued segregation of the Bosnian state, the continued stagnation of many of its political institutions. But I remain committed to the court as being an innovation that is acting as this normative beacon, but also the need for forms of truth and reconciliation, however late and however imperfect, and also to value and cherish the work that goes on within civil society.
Great, thank you. So as we start to wrap up, I just want to ask, this book is fairly new. It came out in December, I think, but I'm sure you sent off the proofs a while ago. So has anything changed your thinking since that happened? Anything new?
Well, actually, the thing I would have liked to have done would be to write about migration more in the book. Clearly, Bosnia's location in the Eastern Mediterranean migratory route makes this a particular issue, especially as other states within the Balkan Peninsula have securitized their borders, leading to further increase in migratory flows. It's created a really significant humanitarian challenge. in a state that is struggling to accommodate its own citizenry, let alone kind of to provide the kinds of humanitarian support that's required for migrants. And so I would have liked to have kind of reflected on this in a greater length somewhere in the book, to think through the ways in which, you know, we were talking about citizenship earlier, you know, the ways in which the arrival of outsiders reveals certain ideas of citizenship and responsibility in Bosnia, and really kind of starkly illuminates, I think, some of these issues around the legal commons, you know, the extent to which people can claim asylum in Bosnia, the extent to which this is a transit and a desire to be elsewhere, which is kind of interesting politically, because as you alluded to in one of your questions, many of the young residents of Bosnia desire to be elsewhere too. So it's a kind of, there's an interesting kind of and very troubling and worrying dynamic there of the issue of the migrant crisis in Bosnia, and how this is kind of a major and significant humanitarian concern of our time.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Alex. Before we go, I'm sure our listeners would be interested to hear what you're working on right now.
Well, right now I'm finishing up the last of three progress reports for the journal Progress in Human Geography. So the first looked at the materiality of court spaces. So we talked about that earlier in this interview, but also the ideas within that work made their way into The Edge of Law. And then the second looked at bodies and the enrollment of bodies within law. And the third is going to look at evidence. And in particular, this question of how does experience become legal evidence? And how have geographers particularly, because it's obviously a progress report in legal geography, how have geographers written about the production of evidence? And I suppose I'm interested in that, and that process will be a synthetic process, in that I'll be looking across work in legal geography that's thought about evidence. And so we start to immediately think about testimony, about material evidence. We start to think about kind of the geopolitical barriers to gaining evidence. Certainly in international law, this is often a significant issue, is whether or not, you know, Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch are allowed permission to enter particular sites, you know, as being in order to gather evidence. So the extent to which particular crimes can be erased, not because they didn't occur, but because no trace of them can ever be reported in a legal sense. So I'm kind of fascinated by this question of evidence, and then kind of leading on to an empirical question of how does the International Criminal Court begin to, how does it select particular events, particular atrocities as being worthy of investigation? And how are those experiences of individuals involved in those atrocities produced as legal evidence? What are some of the processes that have to occur? And some of the kind of institutions that are required. So again, kind of thinking about civil society and the kind of range, the wealth of actors that are involved in legal processes, think about how they are also embroiled in that issue. So just to give a concrete example, would be the plight of Rohingya Muslims in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, who are today gaining a voice in the International Criminal Court through the support of Gambia in supporting their case at the International Criminal Court, in order to be to evidence of their expulsion from Myanmar to be actually investigated, not as a social process, not as a kind of the push and pull of migratory flows or, you know, a geopolitical event, but as a crime, you know, something that actually was criminally. You know, incurs an idea of what is criminally inappropriate behaviour. And so, you know, I'm just really interested in that question of evidence. So how does evidence of those processes get gathered? How are particular voices given credence, and how are others silenced or sidelined?
Sounds fascinating. Thanks for sharing. I'm really looking forward to checking that out when it comes out. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us on the program, Alex.
Thank you very much.
That's it for another episode of New Books in Geography. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for tuning in. You can follow us on Twitter at NewBooksGeog and me at Dino Kadij. Until next time, stay home and stay safe.